Mortal Remembrance, the death that happens and the death that matters. This program has been a long time in the making. As you can imagine from the title alone, this is a very personal and sensitive subject. Although it is done tastefully and focuses in on the importance of human life, it also deals with remembering our loved ones, getting from where we are when death happens to where we need to be as a result of the life change that takes place as we proceed through the mourning process. Listener discretion is advised. Funerals are the way we close the gap between the death that happens and the death that matters. Thomas Lynch takes an interest in how we process the matters of death and dying, life and living. On April 9, 2010, Earthbeat aired a program on Radio Netherlands Worldwide called Dying Green. The show talked about modern burial and how it contributes to environmental pollution. Environmental activists and even some people in the funeral service industry are also saying that today's cremation services also contribute to pollution.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Many of us find it a comforting thought that when we die, our bodies return to the soil and feed the circle of life. Sadly, the reality is a little less romantic and environmentally friendly, and that's causing problems.
We'll talk about all this and much more here on Mortal Remembrance, a Humanity Beat production. What does it mean to close the gap between the death that happens and the death that matters? How do we reconcile the new culture of grieving without the presence of the deceased in the room and deal with death by refusing to live in denial? If burial and cremation are both environmental concerns, how are we to pursue a final disposition for our loved ones and ourselves? The death that happens is more than just a physical death of the person who has ceased to exist. Another death happens in the emotional and psychological aspect in the person who is now the bereaved. The way we choose to memorialize our loved ones, the kind of service we have. At a wake and a funeral, it is a combination of a visitation where the deceased loved one is viewed and we get to form a memory picture with the goal of saying final goodbyes, allowing the family and friends to gather for a collective grieving experience and celebrating the life that once was. The death that matters is the dignity we give to the one we love and afford to ourselves in such a time of hurt. We can process it all emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually. This is the time we have to prepare for the changes in life that take place without the physical presence of that special person. The death that matters is how we get to where we need to be once we get the dead to the place of their final rest. Planning, arranging, processionals, traditions, and rituals. This writer and producer spoke with a pair of licensed clinical social workers about our culture, how we deal with death and the business of living beyond loss, how we assign meaning to our remarkable histories and make sense of life and living, dying and the dead, acknowledging grief in the moment of a reality that we wish were not happening. So much of what we do is done to care for the living, so they can go on even though life has changed. Thomas Lynch has asserted that the living and the dead have a distance to go when someone we love dies. David Fireman and his colleague, KC, are licensed clinical social workers at the historic Center for Grief Recovery and Therapeutic Services, Institute for Creativity and Development. We start our journey with the death that happens. In the offices of David Fireman and KC on Chicago's North Side, Grief and mourning are met with understanding, compassion, expertise, and a deep knowledge that only comes with the intimate living of the everyday human experience. David starts by talking about how the Center for Grief Recovery and Therapeutic Services, Institute for Creativity and Development, started out. He talks about the center's mission and vision. David goes on to educate us on the topics that make up the experience of grief, mourning, and loss. He takes us through the maze of what it means to heal from the human and clinical aspects. KC also joins in each of the conversations with her brand of genuine care from the heart and soul perspective to target the finer points of what is really important. Only when we first do the work of processing the death that happens, only when we face the separate impacts of grief and loss, can we then be in a place where we start to come alive again and recognize the death that matters. Earlier in the program, I had mentioned that the death that happens is, of course, more than just the loved one who ceases to exist. And it's up to us how we make that person's life matter, mm-hmm. and how we live our lives beyond that loss, and how we get to where we're going once we have the dead where they need to be.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, that's very much how this organization began, with the death of one of the co-founder's brothers early in life, died in a hunting accident. And his childhood was shattered by that experience. His name is Dr. Jerry Rothman. And over the years, he, after getting his degree in education and in social work, he began working at a place called the Southern School that dealt here in Chicago with kids mainly from the West and the South sides who were out of mainstream classrooms and school contexts because they couldn't adapt. They were having all sorts of trouble. And he and his colleague, Tom Cole, at the time were looking at why these kids were having such difficulty. And what they came upon was a trend of loss in these various family systems, whether it was loss through death or whether it was loss through incarceration or other forms of loss. This was the common denominator that all these kids were dealing with. And so they developed at that time the Center for Grief Recovery and sibling loss. Many of those losses were siblings who had disappeared in one form or another. And so that was really essentially the birth of this organization, combination of Dr. Rothman losing his own brother, being inalterably affected by that throughout his entire life, and then moving on later on in life to see the same kind of trend in other kids, and so develop a whole series of services for them. You know, there are many theories of grief and grief recovery that have been touted over the many decades, ever since Freud and his Mourning and Melancholia, I think it was in 1917, in which he asserted at the time that the object or the goal of the mourning process was to let go of or decathect from the love object, to sever the tie and to move on and to face what he called the reality principle, to come back to life, to let go of the dead. In some of his private letters, however, it's found that he had sort of the opposite view for himself personally and his friends, that in fact, to the contrary, the mourning process is much more about staying connected to the love object, to the deceased, to remember and recall and recognize and recollect the very personal experiences that we have with one another, as Thomas Lynch pointed out. You know, the whole notion of staying connected, of really having that ongoing tie with the deceased, is the mourning process itself.
The only attachment in a relationship I would say would be unhealthy is that it prevented you from reinvesting in the life that's in front of you. Life moves relentlessly forward. It will always intrude upon whatever path you think you're on and continue to present itself at you. And even the most bereaved will usually eventually take another step toward it. So I would say that your attachment to the dead is only unhealthy if it prevents you from investing in the life that you must live without them physically present. Other than that, I think we are completely illiterate in terms of the possibilities of life and death. There are times when I think the veil is incredibly thin, like a tissue paper, and others where I think it's opaque and reinforced concrete. So I think if we're very lucky, our relationship with the dead continues long enough for us to forgive one another for only having been able to love imperfectly. That's all we have available to us here.
We do like to tell people that there's no timeline for grief, because often folks will begin to feel like they're doing it wrong if they're not feeling better, or that, again, they're going crazy. That on the one hand, but on the other hand, if in fact we are looking at a more, it's always complicated, but there's a term that's been bantied about in the field here of late, complicated bereavement or traumatic grief, sometimes used interchangeably. And in fact, the whole psychiatric field is currently debating whether or not to put a diagnostic category in the newest version of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that's used to identify a whole slew of diagnostic categories. So the debate is, should we put in a diagnosis called complicated grief or traumatic bereavement that distinguishes it from so-called normal grief? That's a hot debate, and personally and professionally, I think it's useful to have categories just so that we can talk to one another about what we're seeing. But in terms of the subjective experience of going through grief, I've never seen a situation that isn't complicated. I've never run across a situation that doesn't have certain traumatic elements when it comes to dealing with the severing of a love attachment. That said, I think there are instances when the normal grief and mourning processes that we all go through can be distorted, derailed, compromised because of various factors like trauma or sudden, unexpected, violent death, the death of a child, death that is perceived as preventable. These are risk factors that I think contribute to a prolonged or a, if you will, more complicated grief and mourning process. And some of the red flags that we would want to look for would be the persistence of belief in seeing the loved one, say after an acute phase of grief, or inability to function in daily life, depression, a clinical depression that might result because of the loss experience, or acute and unrelenting anxiety that interferes with work functioning or making decisions or attending to normal daily life tasks. Those kinds of things we would want to look at, because it would suggest that to the extent that they're prolonged and are persisting, that the person doesn't have the cohesiveness and the structure and the vigor in themselves to move through the confrontation phase of the mourning process, really confronting the loss, and into the accommodation phase of adjusting to the loss, of crossing all of those countless numbers of bridges without the loved one who is now deceased, but with the support of others, and beginning slowly but surely, one bridge after the next, pull back the energy from the lost loved one and putting it into new relationships and new causes.
The first big impact, I think, is the way in which the knowledge of the death is delivered to you. Whether you are with the person who died, if you've ever walked into a room like that, the room is incredibly empty. Incredibly empty. My best friend died in my home on November 14th, and I wasn't present when he died. I found him in the morning. And he was really gone. I've been present when people I love have died. I've held their hands. I've been present for the last sacraments of the church, my church, not everyone's church. And walking into a room with the body of your loved one in it, it's a very different experience. I wrote a poem about it, actually. Whether you discover the body yourself, whether someone delivers the news to you, whether you're in a cold medical environment with strangers, all of that kind of creates the first impact of the death, because the actual feeling of the loss usually follows that. The impact of the death is quite different from the impact of the loss.
KC starts this segment on the topic of denial, human spiritual mystery and death, the sense of failure and guilt, human competency and grieving, and the treasure of human relationships. David Fireman then talks about the role of support in the community, the value of having traditions and rituals, and the role of psychological grief professionals. We then move into The Death That Matters with KC as she talks about richness in relationships, keeping a loved one's story alive, and using a loved one's loss as a way to carry on good things in the world in their memory. David Fireman continues on in the conversation, touching on how we can normalize our grief and loss experience even in the wake of what we may think is abnormal. KC gives us insight about grief needing time to unfold. She makes it clear that we are oftentimes right where we belong in the midst of grief and loss, and that we need not feel pressure to hurry up and just get over it. KC encourages us to welcome the memory of our lost loved ones, and speaks about art expression to have a healthy way to keep our memories, our reminders of the life once lived by that special person, the importance of people caring for each other in the community, the etiquette of people approaching each other during the mourning process, and latitude in planning remembrance ceremonies becomes a prime focus in The Death That Matters.
You know, I shy away from making a lot of generalizations. I think on one hand, the denial of the physical presence of the body is part of our cultural denial of the power of death. That again, it goes back to that scientific failure. If we had just figured it out, this wouldn't have happened. And I think in our scientific and less mysterious minds, we want to distance ourselves from those failures of science that teach us we're not in control of everything. I think of the grief in front of me, embodied in this individual who brings their treasure here to kind of be consecrated. I think, you know, we're not supposed to regard anything as mysterious anymore. I think for most of our ancestors, the triumph of life over death was a theological matter. And now the triumph of life over death is mostly a medical science matter. So the first thing that you're greeted with very often when a loved one dies is the sense of failure, that science has somehow failed someone, or that your loved one has failed science in resisting all efforts to keep them alive. So I think people are burdened in that way in the modern world, first of all, that there's no mystery opening up that they need to explore on the path of grief, but there's a medical science sort of failure. So there's that piece. And I think people in modern life are woefully incompetent when it comes to grieving, because our scientific minds are teaching us all of the time to deny death as something that we ultimately should be able to control with medicine. So the paradox, I think, that's left people of this incredible mystery and loss, what they do with the treasure of this relationship, what they do with the love that still attaches them to the lost loved one, and these filaments that they can neither break nor reel in, leaves them really lonely and confused.
I think that to a large extent, the way humans have been helped through that process is by the religious systems and the religious organizations imposing a certain kind of structure onto the process, a series of steps to help people get through, so that for example, in the Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva, it's 8 days of sitting with family, with friends. That's just the first part of an entire year's process of mourning. But all of the steps are laid out very, very carefully. And the mourners, essentially, are guided through the process by the community, by the neighbors, whether it's people bringing food or whether it's having an identified helper deal with phone calls that need to be made and phone trees that need to be established between people so that the word gets out. On and on and on, there are these supportive mechanisms that are built into the process so that people can get on with the business of remembering and recollecting and reacting to their loss, enfolded within the community. Unfortunately, there are many instances that we see where a person doesn't have a religious connection or a background to which they can rely, on which they can rely, and so they're left on their own, trying to get through a very, very complicated process without the guidelines. And they can, in either instance, they can wind up in our office. In the latter case, being very disoriented and unable to really see the next steps that need to take place. And so we can, in some cases, really become that sort of guide, help people through the beginning stages of the process to help them sort through all of that very, very complicated material. And in the former case, where a person does have that structure around them, from a religious organization or a community, we can be co-companions. We can be guides in helping them to go through all the psychological and emotional and the cognitive and the social and the financial aspects of going through a loss.
Well, I think within the body of the ritual itself, there should be the richness that represents the richness of the relationship. So that can be revealed to the community and shared with the community, just like a Eucharist, just like a communion. You know, we partake of one another and of one another's histories, and we keep the stories alive in the community. Keeping a dead person's story alive is keeping them alive in the community for a period of time. The other thing that I think is really important is to find a way to extend the dead person's goodness into the world. I'm tired of calling them dead people, but that's what they are. They're dead people. Your loved one's goodness into the world. Find some way to meaningfully do something in their name in the world. And I think that propels people down the path of grief with some sense of purpose and a renewed sense of meaning, that you take the meaning that was in the relationship and you carry it toward some other cause and do good with it. I think that's important.
Somebody who has just lost somebody important to them is going through the mourning process. It's pretty common for them to have a sense of their loved one's presence. And this can come through in a vision or in a vivid dream. But it seems to them to be as real can be. So what we like to do is, first of all, ask about that, because people are reluctant to talk about it. People feel like they might be going crazy. And there are some emotional intensities and psychological changes that go on in the wake of a death that can cause people to think that they're going crazy and that, in fact, mimic some forms of mental illness. What we want to do is, first of all, invite people to talk about those experiences and to help them normalize those experiences, but also to find out what those experiences mean to them, whether the experience is a positive one that feels pleasurable and good and helpful and facilitative, or whether it feels negative, that it's uncomfortable or unpleasant. So helping people to feel like they're not going crazy, that it's a normal part of the grief process, because the grief process is really acute in the first few months after a death and can become acute later on in the larger mourning or adaptation process at times around anniversaries and different changes and so on in life. But during that acute phase, it's very common that people have such experiences, and we want to talk to them about that.
Well, what's happening to us is very normal but feels totally other. And the world has very little patience for things that need time to unfold. And grief is one of those things that needs time to unfold. So I think the people in acute grief who are disoriented, who feel like they're, as Dante said, you know, in the middle of their lives, in the middle of the night, in the middle of a dark wood, with no path clear before them, are exactly where they belong. The first thing they need to know is that they're not losing their minds. They have lost something, the magnitude of which will expand and contract over their lifetime and will unfold over their lifetime. So if they can navigate well enough to get into this office, that's part of what they'll hear, that they're exactly where they belong. And rather than submit to the pressure of modern life to abandon the articles of clothing, to get rid of everything, to get on with it, to resume as much of their old life as seamlessly as possible without a backward glance, they'll be encouraged to remain in relationship with their loved one until it changes, until they change, and they will. So they'll be encouraged to speak the names. One of the things that's terrible to lose is the sound of your loved one's name in the world. So we'll use names. If your stepfather's name was Charles, I will ask you where Charles is in the room with us every single time for a while. We'll welcome Charles into the room. We'll welcome the memory. You'll be encouraged to take your time. That the articles of life and clothing and these little things that your loved one touched for the last time and put down and will never touch again are kind of sacred objects until you decide they're not. A lot of people recently are taking the clothes of their dead and making something of them. A quilt or some kind of way to wear some reminder on your body of the person you lost. Because I think one of the hardest things in grieving is that incongruence where the world looks the same. You, for all intents and purposes, look the same. But everything has changed. So, you know, finding a way to attach something of the dead to your life, creating something from the articles of daily living that are left when a person dies, that can be a transformative thing, a quilt or a sculpture, some kind of artful expression that life has changed. Not ended, but changed. I think those things are important. Actually, in the 19th century and early 20th century, taking photographs of the dead, either in their coffins or just before, was very much a fashion. And they were included in the family album, you know, with the living, embedded there forever. You know, the march of generations didn't exclude them. You know, in the 19th century, that alone time was acknowledged by the whole culture. You know, a certain class, when a death occurred in a family, the house was draped in black. The members of the family weren't expected to make calls. People called on them and left cards, so they knew the community was still thinking about them. They were alive in the memories of the community. They wore black for a year, so people knew how to approach you. I think what makes the work of grief so lonely in our culture, in our modern time, is that people don't know how to approach you anymore. You're not schooled in the etiquette of grief. On the other side, I think that there's probably a lot of latitude around making a commemorative service or a memorial process or a funeral personal and meaningful. I think Thomas Lynch, you know, kind of refers to this stuff in a way that sounds like it's a Disneyfication of death. You know, this isn't death, this is the Disney ride. I don't quite see it that way, because I think a lot of people who have been in deep and constant relationships with their loved ones know exactly what they want and shouldn't have to face a lot of criticism or second guessing when they put it together. I think it's hard enough to grieve, and it's hard enough to function when you're grieving, when you're doing the last thing you can possibly do for the person you loved. And so I think there's a lot of latitude there. The only thing I'd like to never hear again at a funeral is, "I did it my way."
As we heard earlier in the program, there seems to be a trend of trauma more closely associated with the grief and mourning aspects of death and dying. David Fireman starts this segment of Mortal Remembrance as we continue in the discussion on the death that matters. David starts by talking about how this trauma is by circumstance that we as a collective society have created in regards to having more weaponry on the streets, drugs and alcohol addictions, warfare, threats of environmental destruction. He says these are ways people are having their normal grief processes derailed, and that accounts for why having a new DSM category could be useful. David goes on to say that diagnostic labels can be just a label, but that they can also be harmful in regards to the mourning and grief process. David talks about remembrance and the ongoing relationship with the deceased, and says that part of what makes a person's death matter is the attention we bring to it. David elaborates on the Jewish tradition of the mourner's Kaddish in the context of remembrance and the death that matters. The topic of physical interaction with our dead as part of mourning becomes a focal point. He talks about how hospice has helped to keep this important interaction relevant in our culture.
I think that as a society today, we are dealing with more trauma, just by circumstance, circumstances that we've created in the area of death and dying. We have more weaponry on the streets. We have more drugs and alcohol addictions. We have, of course, warfare. We have the threat of environmental destruction. We have so many ways in which trauma and death are being more and more closely associated. And so to the extent that that people are essentially having their normal grief processes derailed by traumatic experiences, that they're overwhelmed by the trauma and therefore can't get to the grief, that having a category like that to capture a person who is experiencing that level of intensity, emotional, psychological intensity, could be useful. Could be useful for creating better assessment tools, for training professionals to know what to look for, and then therefore produce and provide the appropriate kind and level of care and treatment. That's all on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that any diagnostic label, whether in this area or another, can be just that, a label that fixes and boxes in a person, and that can do damage to their own sense of self and ability to recover, and it can also create a certain kind of pessimism and short-sightedness in the professionals themselves. I saw a lot of this in working with the elderly. You're getting old, you know. That means depression is right around the corner, or it's normal to be depressed. It's normal to have memory loss. And these were, I think, well-meaning professionals, but uneducated in terms of what the aging process really is and what is normal and what is abnormal. So I think that diagnostic labels can have value, but they can also be quite limited. I think about remembrance. I think about the ongoing relationship with the deceased. A sense of connection, a sense of longing, a sense of essentially relationship that is the mourning process itself. What matters is the attention. What makes death matter is the attention that we bring to it. And that attention can come in many different forms. It can come in the form of for example, a religious or a spiritual ritual. Again, I draw from the, I don't mean to overemphasize it, but I draw from the Jewish tradition, being Jewish myself and having experiences there, both personally, really. But the tradition of Kaddish, I don't know if you're familiar with this, it's the morning prayer. And it's said after the death of a loved one. And it's also said each year in a synagogue for a whole long list of people who have died. And that essentially is an opportunity for people to stand up in the congregation and be recognized as mourners and to be led through the prayer of, it's called the Mourner's Kaddish, with all to see and to hear and to give support for. I think this is a form of remembrance. This is a form of mattering, death mattering, bringing dignity and value to our loved ones who are gone, and also to ourselves, to be recognized and to be supported as mourners. Again, in working with the elderly, a question that came up quite a bit was, who will say Kaddish for me? I found that older people were less afraid of dying and more afraid of not being remembered. And so that very poignant question of who will say Kaddish for me, something that really has lasted with me and has affected the way I think about the death that matters. The death that matters is the death that we pay attention to. I know that things have changed throughout human history in terms of our contact with the dead, and as through the process of industrialization, through the process of civilization, we have become less and less apt to really interact with the dead. It's been sort of closed up behind curtains and doors. Partly what I think changed that, or it has the potential to change that, is the hospice movement in this country, where we have decided as a culture to make those who are going through the dying process and their loved ones more comfortable, to reduce the amount of pain that's associated with whatever illness is at play, and therefore to create a kind of a surround of calm and dignity so that the family and the dying individual can get on with the business of death and dying. However, Cecily Saunders, the founder of the hospice movement, said that death is an outrage. And I think it's that sort of, for everything that hospice has done and is doing to transform our relationship with dying and the dead, I think that idea or that statement is at the bottom of your question and Thomas Lynch's concern that death is an outrage, in a sense reflects the kind of mentality and assumptions that we have about dying, that instead of seeing dying as a natural part of the life cycle, something that we need to face and can face in ways that are more healthy for us, we have tended to see it as an outrage, as something we need to conquer. You know, we have people who come to us who never saw the dead body of their loved one and who are frozen in a kind of trauma of not knowing whether to believe it has actually occurred. So one of the stages of the grieving process is to recognize the reality of what has occurred. And what better way to recognize the reality of what has occurred than to interact with the body of the deceased in some form or fashion, whether it's through a ritual washing of the body, as is done in many religious systems, wrapping the body in white linen. There are other forms of actual physical interaction with the body as a ritual and as a way to set in this recognition of the reality. So to the extent that we don't have those customs and rituals built in, I think I'd have to agree with Mr. Lynch that it doesn't serve us well, and that we are perhaps more likely to suffer from more complicated and traumatic forms of bereavement and not be able to get on with the business of accommodating to the loss. But where those customs are still taking place, I think you would see that the mourning processes are more successful for the survivors. Well, I think a lot of this fear, it really is fear of death, comes from the way we're taught, our conditioning, our social conditioning around death and dying. It's very uncommon for people to share feelings of, people who are less anxious about the process. I don't see very many people like that. Why would that be? I would think that, you know, much of it comes from our cultural values and the emphasis that American society puts on productivity and on youthfulness and on beauty. These are the values that we worship. Even to get old in this society is, let alone die, is problematic for most of us because of our social conditioning around how oldness and sickness are equated. I always thought that was interesting. It's not getting old that's so bad. It's being old and sick that is really problematic. And that it's not a pathology to become old and to die, but it's pathological to think that getting old and dying is something that should cause us great anxiety and difficulty. With the right supports, with the right ideas, I think we can face and confront the fact of getting older and the fact of dying much more naturally. I think it was Arnold Toynbee, the historian, who said, not death, but grief is un-American. We have a certain tradition of stoicism, certain kind of get on with it. We see this sometimes in businesses where there's been a death in the workplace, for example, and we get a call for somebody to come out and deal with a staff. Sudden, unexpected death of an employee, a colleague, conversations left unfinished, emails left unsent, voicemails, so on and so forth. How does a small company deal with something like that? Does it stop business as usual and take time to process the occurrence? And if so, how long does the management give for this grief debrief or psychological first aid process to unfold? In many, many places, not just corporate America, it's let's get back to business as usual. So I think that in many ways, from the way we learn as children through our social conditioning about what death and dying means, and we get most of those lessons from our family, and our family, of course, gets their lessons from generations past. So these ideas and values about whether death and dying and sickness and old age are a natural part of the life course, or whether they're not, whether they're to be feared or whether they're to be accepted, comes from generations and generations of ideas handed down and then landing in our own laps as we're children, and those beliefs and those ideas become essentially who we are, or whether it's how we, in a larger sense as a culture, confront these realities. Between those two influences, I think that's where we get our notions. I would go back to what that individual has seen, felt, heard, sensed from older people, his seniors, in other words, and mainly in the family structure, but by extension, in the larger culture, in the peer group, in the teachers, in the churches, on the TV, through the media more generally, and so on and so forth. So I would think that that sort of individual who has that kind of fear wasn't born with that fear, but learned that fear from the social environment. And that fear essentially goes back to, it could go back to a number of things: fear of contagion, fear of, just fear of being around the deceased. There are historical precedents for all of that. Some people have a great deal of anxiety about being in the room. Where those ideas come from, I think family, mainly. That's a fascinating question. I really don't, to be honest with you, I don't know where it would have started. I think perhaps, if we just look at American history, to go back to industrialization, to go back to when, you know, families were essentially broken apart, separated, fragmented, as the agrarian culture and society shifted, and the children moved into the urban centers and the cities, that there was less and less contact with the land, and therefore less and less contact with the natural cycles of the seasons. I would guess that as a result of that process over the generations, we've had then therefore less and less contact with the death and dying process and with spending time with the deceased. You know, industrialization, mechanization, the advent of more and more computer technology and so on, essentially separating people from one another in many, many ways, also bringing them closer, but virtually closer, not really closer. So it seems to me like perhaps, and I don't know this for a fact, I'm just hypothesizing here as we're speaking, perhaps industrialization in and of itself is responsible for some of this disconnection that we have with one another and with ourselves and our dead. While grief and mourning are universal processes, they are extremely personal, so that no two people have the same brain, no two people have the same grief and mourning process. It depends on a lot of different factors. It depends on the circumstances of the death. It depends on the amount and the degree and the perceived degree of support that the person has received after the death. It depends on personality characteristics that are brought into the grief and mourning process, that have preceded the grief and mourning process. It depends on religious and spiritual beliefs. so many different influences that come to bear on the process. That said, I think that oftentimes what people experience in the first stages or phases are these acute psychological, emotional, behavioral, social, cognitive events, phenomena. You mentioned guilt in some instances, a kind of, one of the cardinal characteristics is longing for contact, longing for reforming the tie with the deceased. That certainly, I think, is a very, very common experience. There may be profound sadness. There may be profound relief. There may be a kind of numbing, especially in the beginning phases, where there's a shock, even in a death that wasn't sudden or unanticipated, a kind of shock, and I believe a biologically determined shock phase, a kind of a anesthesia effect to help protect us reflexively from the assault on the self of this new profound and unimaginable reality. So oftentimes we will see people who are disoriented and in a kind of numb baseline place. Shock is often used to describe that. So we're trying to get at, psychologically speaking, what is the inner landscape and how does the self react to this kind of separation? Vulnerability, feelings of helplessness and hopelessness. A whole range of different kinds of reactions. Some people cognitively will begin to have a lot of difficulty thinking clearly or of being able to concentrate on the tasks at hand, which is why it's really good and useful and helpful to have somebody as a guide to walk with them step by step. Behaviorally, they may not be able to show up to work as usual, or may be unavailable to their loved ones, children, spouses, will be rendered unable temporarily to really perceive what others' needs are because of their own emotional and psychological processes. So, you know, we see a whole range of reactions and also depth of reactions. I see, along with Therese Rando, who is a very good person to look at, if you haven't already, in the grief and mourning literature. I agree with her that there's a difference between grief and mourning. I think grief is, as she points out, is the all those acute reactions that we were talking about earlier, the psychological, emotional, cognitive, behavioral reactions that we have in the face of a loss. And that grief is a smaller part of a larger experience called mourning. And the mourning process is the slow, in most instances slow, not always 15 years, but slow accommodation, adaptation, adjustment to the loss. All those many bridges to cross, all those many decisions to make, all of that psychological and emotional and spiritual energy being withdrawn from the deceased and being put into new relationships and new causes and new ideas. That's the mourning process. And how long it takes, it depends on all those things that we talked about earlier. But I would say that 15 years is the number that comes to my mind, I'm thinking of this one woman who I saw for not that many years, but close to it, who lost her husband on their honeymoon in an accident. And it has taken her a long time to recover from that loss and be able to reinvest herself in her life and in new relationships. Well, my mind goes to the progenitor, the originator of self-psychology, Heinz Kohut, who in his later years talks about the transformation of narcissism over time, and that as the goal would be throughout human development for us to, as we prepare to die, as we face our mortality, to have wisdom and a sense of humor and an appreciation of impermanence and empathy, and to bring those qualities to bear not only toward ourself, but toward our loved ones in the process, so that the transformation of narcissism really means accepting one's role and status as less and less central and more adjunctive. It passing the torch, providing the role model for facing death with these qualities, and doing it through a ritual or sharing one's process with loved ones, I think is, again, all to the good. I think that there are certain economic and social circumstances that would either promote and encourage that kind of a process, and some that certainly would detract from it. In other words, people who are living in more difficult circumstances where the transformation of narcissism isn't quite as easy, if you will, although there are exceptions to that rule too, those kinds of situations, you'd be more hard-pressed in many instances to see that kind of effect. But again, one never knows. It really does depend on the individual. Going back to use the psychological terminology, pre-morbid personality characteristics, you know, in other words, who we were, who we are, and who we were, often, more often than not, comes into the experience of dying. And so I remember one of my older clients saying, if you're a schlock person when you're a kid, you're probably going to be a schlock person when you're a senior, unless something really profound happens along the way. If you're a narcissist as a 16-year-old and you never quite get over it, it's pretty likely that you're going to be a narcissist as you're facing your own death. And so the way we live is often very, very influential. I don't know that it determines necessarily, but influential in the way that we die and the way that we approach our dying. I wouldn't be sitting in my chair and doing what I do if I didn't believe that there was a possibility of transforming narcissism. And I think people who are dealing with loss of a loved one, as painful and as much as that fact of life needs to be felt and hopefully coped with and adapted to, it seems to me like there's a profound moment of possibility there for encouraging the transformation of narcissism. In other words, by facing death and dying, we can also not just feel the pain, but feel the possibility of growth and development, and use the experience to push us into a form of creativity and a form of adaptability that we couldn't otherwise have experienced. I think it's Khalil Gibran who says, you know, the profundity of love itself isn't really felt or realized until the hour of loss. It's that relationship between love and loss, between grief and creativity, that I'm particularly interested in. And it's not for everybody. We have grief groups here, and for some people it's just enough to get back to my normal level of functioning before all this happened. And I don't want to hear about transformation of anything. I just want to hear about getting back to my job and moving on with my life. For others, it can be an opportunity, not just to adapt, but to really transform their lives.
It's a working time. And it would be a very unusual grief and mourning to experience no regret and no guilt. We're human. It's a part of the trappings. And when I talked about, you know, the relationship with your loved one only damaging you if it prevents you from moving forward, that you need to remain in relationship with the person you've lost long enough to forgive one another for being imperfect in your love. Imperfect love is all we've got. It's darn good, but its failings and deficits are really glaringly obvious when someone has died. That you relive every single moment where you might have done something more, you might have done something better, and it's just a part of being a human being. Because when you're in relationship with people in the present, you can't anticipate their death. You're in the present, you're living the present, you're living in relationship, so you don't live as though you're going to have to revisit that moment 500 times once they're gone. So that's what I think that time is for, when the world sort of pulls away and you're back intimately connected with the person who has died. It's for working through the imperfections of having been human. We have a funeral, and then the world is telling you, you need to get on with it. No matter how raw you are, no matter how ill-equipped you feel. So that's kind of a long answer about what that time is for. I don't think it should be as alone as it is. I think it's way too lonely for many people because other people don't know how to approach the grieving anymore. But I think it's a valuable time to come to some sort of reconciliation with yourself and with the person who has died. I think the bottom line, and it's something Thomas Lynch talks about in his book, The Undertaking, is that the most basic underlying thought is that if life matters, death matters. And I think we live in a world where lives matter a whole lot less than they should. And so death matters a whole lot less than it should. I work with people who've been grieving for a decade sometimes. There is no deadline, but you know, again, it's part of the loss of mystery. If we look at life as just the division of cells, and death as the end of the metabolic process in those cells, then life does not matter as it should, and death does not matter as it should.
David and KC, thank you for taking the time to be such a valuable part of the community and being here with us on this very first Humanity Beat documentary, Mortal Remembrance, as we document the life that matters by taking such a deep and meaningful journey through the death that happens and the death that matters.
The program introduction featured the voice of a young woman who spoke briefly about environmental concerns regarding the funeral industry. That was none other than the voice of Earthbeat's Marnie Chesterton. Marnie now joins us with an Earthbeat piece called Dying Green from April 10, 2010. That aired on Radio Netherlands Worldwide. Marnie?
I'm Marnie Chesterton. It's an issue many people would prefer to bury, but body disposal has a big impact on our environment. My colleague Fiona Campbell has this 60-second introduction to the hazards of toxic bodies.
Earthbeat's Enviro Minute.
Your body may be a temple, but it's also toxic waste. There is cadmium in your liver, lead in your bones, and mercury in your tooth fillings. When you die, this creates problems. The ground surrounding graveyards often becomes polluted, and contaminants can leach into the water supply. It's not just the body that goes into a hole in the ground. As part of the burial, we add many other hazards, from concrete to toxic paint and metals. But don't think cremation's any better. During the burning process, all the pollutants are released into the atmosphere. A single body isn't a huge burden on the environment, but think about it. A global population of almost 7 billion now means 7 billion bodies in 100 years' time, and that's an awful lot of funerals.
Enviro Minute from Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
So on this edition of Earthbeat, we're looking at the footprint of the final journey. Different cultures take a very different approach to disposing of their dead, but according to Joe Sihe of the Green Burial Council, modern-day burial techniques are often unnecessarily polluting to the environment. Joe spoke to me from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and started by explaining how a green burial can do it better.
Well, green burial is burial that can take place without the use of toxic chemicals, without contributing to waste. It essentially has come to be defined as burial without the use of metal caskets, concrete burial vaults, and embalming fluid using toxic chemicals. But everything has its environmental externalities. We bury in this country about 800,000 gallons of a known carcinogen, formaldehyde, in the ground because of embalming. We bury so much metal, I calculated in caskets, that we could rebuild the Golden Gate Bridge each year, and we bury more concrete, 1.6 million tons, as a result of burial vaults to construct a two-lane highway from New York to Detroit. So there's a tremendous carbon footprint with that, obviously, and so we're just providing options for families who want to make sure their last act is not one an act of pollution and, where possible, actually contributes to some healing on the planet.
Are most people aware of what goes into a grave?
I don't think most people have really wanted to peek behind the curtain. Quite frankly, I think some of the ickier aspects of death care have protected it. And what's happened is, I think, green burial provides a context for people to want to think and talk about death and death care. And we've learned that it actually provides solace, you know, allowing people to know that they're going to live and die and decay and be reborn in some fashion is okay. But that's not what's been going on. The death care in this part of the world, and there aren't too many parts of the world where it is done this way, about six or seven countries, but really in America, death care has been about impeding the process of decay and regeneration.
Why is that?
Well, I think it plays into our interest in sanitation that came about in the mid-20th century, what I often refer to as the better dying through chemistry era. We set up this alienation between the decedent and the family, and I think the medical community, quite frankly, did it first. And a lot of aspects of death care are icky to some. We've propped up a myth in this country that the body is protected from the elements through chemicals that it's infused with, and a metal casket that's sealed, and then another big box made out of concrete. The fact is, anaerobic bacteria does its thing, and body tissues liquefy, body cavities burst.
This is the icky stuff you were talking about.
This is the icky stuff. And now we're seeing people return to the way most of humanity has cared for its dead for thousands of years.
Now, not all cultures go in for burial, and I'm wondering about the alternatives. For example, how green is cremation?
The Green Burial Council has been trying to stay away from a good, better, and best approach. I think cremation, for example, has been badly diminished by some people in the Green Burial movement. They know something's coming out of a smokestack, and they're concerned about that. But we actually hired an environmental planning firm to help us put together an offset program and discovered that it took about a $4 contribution to a carbon fund to offset the typical cremation. That's not a lot of CO2 compared to what we expend in our daily lives, heating and cooling our homes and driving our cars around. But it does matter to some people, and offsetting is being done. We need to be careful. I'm a former Jesuit lay minister and officiant, and as I like to say, you know, ritual cannot be dictated or codified or handed over to us on any sort of platter, even a non-toxic biodegradable one, if it's to really work. And we really need to back off and let people do what they think is the most appropriate thing to honor the dead, heal the living, and invite in the divine.
Because it is a sensitive issue.
That's right. You know, I think it's really rotten to make people feel bad about having embalmed their mother or cremated their father. I think we need to educate people so they make good decisions and understand that whatever they want can be done in a more environmentally sustainable manner.
You're listening to Earthbeat. I'm Marnie Chesterton. As you heard from Joe C. here, there's real room for improvement in the funeral industry. And maybe this involves taking a more practical attitude to disposing of bodies. One crematorium in Taiwan has even figured out a way of generating electricity from the heat coming out of the ovens. But in this conservative Buddhist island, the idea is agitating some age-old superstitions. I spoke to correspondent Keith Perron in Taipei, and he explained exactly what the crematorium was up to.
Well, it is very interesting. Effectively, what they're doing is the ovens that perform the cremations generate heat of around 1,000 degrees centigrade. And when this funeral parlor, which is funeral parlor number 2, went under some renovations last year, they decided to install a system which effectively takes the heat, heats up water, the water turns to steam, and then that turns a turbine, which then turns a generator, and then produces electricity to run the air conditioning, the lights in the offices, including a cafe that they have at the funeral parlor.
Okay, and just to be clear, this isn't burning bodies to make electricity.
No, all it's doing is using the heat from the ovens to generate electricity. The bodies that are inside the oven are not involved in this process at all. This funeral parlor, by the way, does do around 52 to 55 cremations a day. So if the oven is running at 1,000 degrees centigrade through almost the entire day, you can imagine how much electricity that does generate.
Okay. So despite the fact that it's not directly the corpses that are being turned into electricity, this is still causing a stir amongst the residents of Taipei.
It's causing a stir only because one of Taipei city councillors, he brought up in the Taipei City Council, he said that this was really bad. This was showing no feelings towards the mourners and the families of the people who have passed on. And then all of a sudden, in one of the local Taiwan newspapers, they ran a headline. And if you translate the headline from Chinese into English, it basically means mourners wait while drinking cappuccino and their loved ones are being used to provide energy.
I can see that that's a tad insensitive, but is there an element of the belief that sort of specifically says your loved ones can't be useful as a source of electricity?
There isn't anywhere in Buddhist scripture, well, at least the Buddhist scripture here in Taiwan, that says that. But some of the local politicians and the Taiwan media are playing this song. Unfortunately, it's also a generational thing as well. Usually people of a certain generation are much more superstitious. So even though the bodies themselves are not being used to generate electricity, the fact that the oven is doing the cremation has caused enough people to feel extremely uncomfortable about this.
And has everyone reacted poorly, or are there some people who are recognizing the environmental benefit, or indeed the economic benefit of doing this?
depends on generation. One of the local Taiwan newspapers did a poll, and they discovered that 70% of the people polled were against this idea. And then they mentioned that, you know, the people that were polled were over 50 years old. When they interviewed the younger generation, say under 35, it was around 63% were supporting the idea. Now, Taiwan has been very active in bringing its emission levels for the following year, 2010, down to the levels of 2007. And this is a government plan. At the same time, people are looking at the aspect of saving money. Now, when I spoke to the director of the funeral parlor, he said that prior to having the system installed, they were spending roughly around $324 a day. Since they've had the system installed, it's less than $92 a day. So people now, the younger generation, and even some of the older generation that are, you know, very superstitious, are looking at this as a way of saving money. It's better for the environment. It reduces CO2 emissions. And now they're thinking, is this the way to go? Not just with funeral parlors, but also in other fields as well, like smelting, for example.
Keith, will superstition win out over environmental good sense?
Well, the way Taiwan works is that this is going to cause some controversy for a little while, but then people will look at the savings. Eventually, superstition will be put aside, but it takes a little time to make that change here in Taiwan.
Keith Perron in Taipei, Taiwan. This is Earthbeat from Radio Netherlands Worldwide. I'm Moni Chesterton. So far, we've heard about the efforts to make burials and cremations more environmentally sound. But soon, the world may have another option. It's called promession. It's a process that breaks the body down into small pink crumbs of organic matter, like human soil, if that isn't too unpleasant a thought. The brains behind promession is Swedish biologist Suzanne V. Masak. Approaching the problem as a biologist, Suzanne says that dead organic matter, for example, a corpse, has three options. It can either turn into soil, rot, or burn. And these days, most of us are not turning into soil.
This is just my own theory. What was meant to be from the beginning, when only a few people were living on this planet. So when we died, we just fell down and were taken care of, if you say so, by the wild animals.
Then we started living in societies, and instead of leaving behind our dead loved ones as we went on our nomadic way, we started hiding them, first under stones and branches, and then later deep down in the earth.
No person at all today end up with soil if they aren't left in nature together with the wild animals.
Well, feeding dead bodies to wild animals is unlikely to catch on, but Vig Masak has come up with a process that breaks down the body in a different way, allowing human remains to be buried cleanly. Here's the recipe. Don't try this at home. First, the body is frozen to minus 18 degrees. It's then sunk into a bath of liquid nitrogen, deep freezing the body and making it brittle.
And then we use a mechanical vibration, only 5 millimeters in amplitude. And with that vibration in combination with this cold temperature, makes the body falls apart within seconds. And then we transport to a chamber of vacuum so that all the water is evaporated. And it means that the body turns into a dried powder.
After the body's all broken up, it's possible to remove any metals that were once inside it. For example, tooth fillings or things put in during surgery. Once you've been frozen and shaken,
everything that was you is still there. So if you're 100 kilos from the beginning, there will be 30 kilos of remains left.
And how much is that? What does it look like?
It looks like a pink beige powder, or rather pieces, small pieces. You can't see what it has been. And it is intended that those remains are going back to the soil as a gift and creating new life, and that is probably the biggest difference.
Now, you say that promession is a much more ecologically responsible burial, but it sounds like there's a lot of freezing and shaking, and that takes a lot of energy. So is this actually environmentally friendly?
Yes, I'm very grateful that you bring that subject up, because the air that we breathe is around 80% of nitrogen and 20% of oxygen, and the biggest energy source that we have with this freezing is that we use liquid nitrogen, which is a rest resource from the oxygen production that goes to the hospitals. So you could say that we are lucky to be able to use something that should have been produced whether we used it or not. So
you're using a byproduct?
Yes, the consequences for nature is very, very few. But the biggest thing when it comes to talking about why is this more ecologically friendly, it is that if you look upon it from totally from the outside of the planet and look at the Earth as a big system, you could see that if we are soon 7 billion people on this planet, and within 100 years all those 7 billion will be dead, and all of us, we have been building our bodies from what was produced in the soil. I mean, we did eat the plants to live, either as plants or through animals. So you could say we are really originating from the soil. And today, with traditional burial or with cremation, we are not going back to the soil. We are instead overloading systems that is something to be very careful with. I mean, with traditional burial, we all know that it is more or less going to end up in the water system or in the groundwater table. And with cremation, most of the human body goes up in the air. And no one today is going back to the soil where we came from.
If I can get personal, is this how you want to go when you die?
Yes, definitely. My parents as well. They were born 1918 and 1923, so they died now a couple of years ago, both of them. And I was very grateful that we talked about this together before they died, and they definitely wanted this as well. So their bodies are kept in freezing rooms at crematoriums in Sweden, waiting for this method to be ready to use. And I feel very proud of being able to do this for them, because I know that I want the best for their bodies. I mean, it's not that it's the only thing that is important. It's, of course, the way they lived and the way we live together. But knowing that I, with the facts that I have, I really want to take care of their bodies in the best of ways.
Wow, so they've been on ice waiting for the red tape to give them the go-ahead.
Yes, there has been a wish from a lot of people saying that this is the only thing I really want. And I think it has to be respected, because it's an important thing for people. Once they know that they are going to die, they think about their destiny. And if this could be something appealing, making them less scared, meeting their own death, I think it's important for people.
It really takes a scientist to casually announce that they're keeping their parents in a freezer. Suzanne Wieg-Massak expects the world's first promession centre, or promatorium, to open in Sweden in 2010, and countries all over the world are expressing interest, so expect one to come to a town near you someday soon.
Earthbeat, listening to the world's heartbeat.
Each funeral choice has its own pros and cons. Back to Joe Sheehy from the Green Burial Council, who says that they make a point of saying that there's no clear right and wrong way of having a green death.
There have been a couple attempts to do that analysis, and they always seem to fall short, and it's very difficult. We're just putting our resources into making sure that there are more eco-friendly options available for families and allow them to choose what makes most sense. Let me tell you how complicated it's going to get. Look at caskets, for example. There are some people, for example, that really want to make sure that they're made from sustainable timber. Well, that's fine. Does it matter, for example, if that sustainable timber comes from China? There's a big carbon footprint associated with that. Do you care about the labor conditions in that plant in China? Do you know much about it?
It sounds like, in America at least, the death industry has been quite removed from the concept of natural. Do you think that's just going to be a blip? Do you think it's going to return to becoming more and more green?
I think people are actually getting excited talking about this concept. What they're really trying to do, I think, is befriend death earlier in life, which is something that our culture has taken away from us. So green burial is really, as I said, providing a way to invite us in to think about this. And it provides a great deal of solace. This is not a creepy topic. It's not depressing. And I think that society has done us a disservice to think that we can stave it off, we can cheat death by, you know, enough trips to the gym and plastic surgery and what have you. I think this is going to do some powerful things and in ways that we can't even imagine.
That was Joe Sheehy from the Green Burial Council. You can find their web address at our site, rnw.nl/earthbeat, or you can also visit our Facebook page at earthbeatrnw.
Earthbeat, powered by good ideas, from Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
This has been a Humanity Beat radio documentary. Thank you for listening to this very first program called Mortal Remembrance, focusing in on the death that happens and the death that matters. All sound bites used are copyright protected by the original owners of that material and were used in this program in compliance with United States copyright law. You can view the Humanity Beat blog by pointing your browser to www.humanitybeat.blogspot.com. You can follow Humanity Beat on Twitter by typing the @ and then writing Humanity Beat, or by going to facebook.com/humanitybeat. In addition to this, Humanity Beat also has a YouTube channel for all to enjoy by going to youtube.com/humanitybeat. Until next time, keep living the life that matters.